these things are amazing. But, you know, they've always been that way. And they were here in the world before we were here. We shouldn't be amazed. The most amazing thing is that we are such strangers in our own world. You don't know where your food comes from. You don't know how your water gets to your house. You don't know where your garbage goes. You don't know anything about life around you. You don't know much about living things and biology. And you're considered an educated person. That is amazing. And that when we discover these little basic things about animals, we find it amazing. But really, it should be how we know and love and appreciate the world around us. I mean, you know, we live on a miraculous planet.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. This season is all about the mind, and not just the humankind. Today, we'll be talking about whales, elephants, wolves, dogs, octopuses, and a very special bird. We'll explore how they think, feel, and connect, and what their worlds might reveal about our own. And for that, guess with whom we'll be talking.
Our guest today is Carl Safina, ichthyologist, scientist, and storyteller, and one of the world's most eloquent voices for the living Earth. He's the inaugural endowed professor for nature and humanity at Stony Brook University, where he also co-chaired the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science and founder of the Safina Center, where science and art meet to inspire conservation. He earned his PhD in ecology at Rutgers with pioneering seabird studies, then spent a decade helping to ban high seas drift nets and reform U.S. fishing policy. His leadership and vision have been honored with the MacArthur Genius Prize, Pew and Guggenheim Fellowships, awards from Lannan, Orion, and the National Academies, and medals, including the John Burroughs, James Beard, and George Rabb. As an author, he's given us environmental classics, Song for the Blue Ocean, Eye of the Albatross, The View from Lazy Point, Beyond Words, Becoming Wild, and most recently, Alfie and Me, alongside a 2024 children's book, Owls in Our Yard. Through these works, Carl shows us the consciousness, intelligence, and culture of whales, wolves, elephants, and birds, their empathy, their traditions, and what we humans can learn from their relationships. In addition to his writing, Dr. Safina brought his voice to television as host of the PBS series Saving the Ocean, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Audubon, National Geographic, among others. Carl Safina's legacy is more than prizes and books. It's his vision of kinship, reminding us that protecting nature is really about protecting ourselves, and that in learning from animals, we rediscover essential aspects of what it means to be human and the responsibilities that come with it.
I want it to be mine. I want it to be small town bars and desert stars and a station wagon. And my mom, Jean, said, you can spread your wings and wrap me up and keep me. Dr. Safina, it's such a delight to have you with us today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's really a delight to be speaking with you from across the ocean and across the continent.
Well, I have to say that getting ready for this interview has been a real treat, because I had the opportunity to spend some quality time with my youngest son watching a couple of documentaries, and one of which we both loved was David Attenborough's Life in Color. In that documentary, we learned very interesting things, such as the fact that patterns like the stripes on a tiger aren't just beautiful, but they're also essential for survival. Deer, the tiger's natural prey, cannot tell the difference between green and orange. So while a tiger appears bright orange to us, it looks green to deer, helping the tiger to stay hidden and making it easier to hunt. So we were watching this and learning about how technology is helping us to see things in amazing new ways, revealing information about the world of animals, what they do, their language, and so on. But then I started reading your books, and this gave me something that was key to understanding why learning about animals doesn't come just from watching them through cameras, documentaries, or new technologies. It also deepens on how we see them. And so my question is, what do you think makes someone a really good observer of animals? What kind of attention or attitude does it take?
Oh, that's a great question, and no one has ever asked me that question before. I should point out that right behind me is a photograph that I took of a tiger in India. So that was perfect for your opening. What kind of attention does it take? Well, I'm not exactly sure of the best answer to that. I can only answer about me. So this is not advice. It's just about myself. I always thought that anything any other kind of animal did was just sort of fascinating, a little bit like watching a fire. It's always changing, and it just keeps your attention. There's a certain fascination to the flames. I've always felt that way about other animals, whether when I was a little boy, my father bred canaries. That was his hobby. So we had these little birds in cages in our apartment. There were pigeons outside. I just always found them all really interesting. The stray cats that lived in the backyards where I lived when I was a kid in New York City. I always found them really interesting, just wanting to see what they do.
Dr. Isafina, when you were a kid, and I read this in one of your books, your father gave you a flock of pigeons that you were now mentioning. And you talk in your book about how suddenly your backyard was full of personalities, quirks, and tiny mysteries. And those birds became your first teachers in patience, observation, and the art of seeing the world through someone else's eyes, I think. And as a child, I suspect, though, that these observations happened initially out of simple curiosity. And so what I really want to learn is, when did your first manage to step out of that human-centered perspective and really start observing animals without the expectation of animals having to be like us? What age was that? What phase in your life? Because this is coming to a big realization.
When I was 7 years old, I started raising homing pigeons. And as a little boy, you know, you have a lot of time. And I would just stand in the coop and watch them. And I would let them out and I would watch them fly. And in the coop, when people raise pigeons, they have a stack of nests, which were a stack of boxes. They were fruit boxes, actually, that we got from the grocery store. And we put them there in little bowls, and the pigeons decided who they were going to marry. And they made their homes, and they had their babies, and the parents left every day, and then they came back later in the day, and they fed their babies, and they went to sleep. And right across the yard, I lived in an apartment building, which was like a stack of boxes, where the people decided who they were going to marry, and the parents left every day, and then they came back, and they fed their babies, and they went to sleep. So in a way, I certainly wasn't looking for them to be like us. I wasn't saying that unless they're like us, they're less good, they're less valuable. But what I was seeing was that they were like us and we were like them, and that for the most part, life is one family, and that most basically, we shared more than we differed. Now, humans are very different from other animals, mostly technologically, right? But we are animals, and we still have our basic needs, which is to feel safe, to find and have enough food to raise our children. And this is the imperative that we see in all the animals all around us. So they always feel like my neighbors. They feel like part of one family. And just like my human neighbors are different from us, some of them are very different from us. These wild animals are different from us, and some of them are very different from us, but I do feel a strong sense of family with them, really. And that's what we know biologically, is that we are literally all one family in the history of life on this planet.
And I suppose that observing animals in a lab or any other controlled environment versus observing them in their natural habitats has a significant impact on what we can learn about them. This also made me think of cognitive psychologist Dr. Gary Klein, who studies how experts such as firefighters, pilots, surgeons, and military commanders make tough decisions in a matter of seconds. And to examine how these excerpts recognize patterns, rely on intuition, and cope with stress, Dr. Klein came with a pioneer idea of stepping out of the lab to study these events into real-world environments. And by doing this, he and his team were able to uncover subtle cues that would have otherwise remained hidden. And Dr. Safina, you've spent a lot of time watching animals in their natural habitats. And I know elephants hold a special place for you. Could you give us an idea of what life is like for elephants in the wild, and how do they form family connections and communicate? And is there anything that stands out as being strikingly different from elephants living in zoos?
Sure. Well, elephants are very, very family oriented. The females live in family groups their entire lives. The males live with their mothers until they become teenagers. And then they leave and they join other groups of young males. And then when they get to be really adults, when they're about 30 or more years old, the males tend to travel alone and visit families of females for obvious reasons, I might say. And the females, though, are very tightly bonded in their families. They feel a lot of distress if they get separated. If it's a very windy day and they can't hear each other, they call a lot to make sure that they know where everybody is. Because even an elephant, which is a very large animal relatively, can easily get lost from view in the bush. They disappear pretty quickly. They walk astonishingly quietly. And so they're constantly keeping track of where the other members of their family are. And if anything bad happens, it causes tremendous distress and usually attempts to save or help the one that's in trouble, depending on what the trouble is. That is, you know, a very recognizable thing for us because we are also very socially oriented, group oriented, and family oriented. But those elephants stay with their families for decades, which is their whole lifespan. They live about as long as humans do. So it's very recognizable. That is one of the reasons I think that I am so touched and so moved by them. In zoos, in the old days anyway, elephants were usually treated and kept really terribly in ways that did not suit their psychology at all. In really good modern zoos, which is a fraction of the zoos, you know, there are still bad zoos, but there are some really good modern zoos. They keep elephants in groups where they know each other very, very well. They, you know, they're with each other every day. and they have room. Some of them have circular enclosures, so the elephants are never just up against a corner. But in the wild, they travel long distances every day. They know their routes. They follow the matriarch, who may remember what happened 20 years ago or 30 years ago in the last drought and where the last water was. There's nothing really like that in a zoo. So zoo life for elephants is very, very, very boring. And the best zoos recognize that, and they're constantly changing things for the elephants. They feed them differently every day. They make it hard for them to get food. They have a pond or a place where the elephants can not only drink, but also can get in the water, and circular enclosures so that they don't just wind up in a corner doing nothing. But a zoo for an elephant with a mind like an elephant has and as family-oriented as they are is a very, very, very simplified existence. It's kind of like keeping humans under house arrest, I guess I would say.
And so, speaking about the elephant's mind and memory and reminding themselves of these routes, I mean, they're very famous for that, for having this memory. Is it true they can actually recognize hundreds of individual humans?
Of individual humans?
Yeah, like the faces of hundreds of people.
I'm not sure if they can recognize hundreds of individual humans. They can recognize hundreds of individual elephants, though. That is certainly true. I don't know if elephants really get much of a chance to be around hundreds of the same humans long enough for that to be even a thing that would be relevant to them. But they certainly can recognize hundreds of elephants. They know the different families. Some families are really good friends with other families, and then some families don't really like to hang out with some other families. So in a strange way, that too is very similar to the way humans are. We like some people, we like some families, they become close friends very quickly, and others we just don't have the same feelings about.
In your book, Becoming Wild, you mention an experiment that shows how macaws and the African grey parrot could understand delayed gratification and the value of currency by learning to take a non-edible token instead of food so that they could trade the token later for food they liked better. And that blew my mind. Now, with the new technology available, we still cannot physically observe animals or human minds. But what we can do is to observe human brains and animals' brains. How do animals' brains function? Are there any similarities with the human brain?
Well, it depends what you mean by animals, because, you know, animals is everything from coral and sponges to worms to elephants and whales and humans. So let's just say that what we're talking about is vertebrates. All vertebrates have basically the same brain. Mammals have a thing called a neocortex, but what the neurobiologists have been finding for the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, is that other animals accomplish the same things with different structures. So mammals have a neocortex that has a lot to do with cognition. Birds have a pallium, and it's built a little differently, but it serves the same function. And what makes vertebrates conscious, aware of the world, aware of their surroundings, is actually in the oldest part of the brain, in the brain stem, the part that is closest to the spinal cord itself. So many of our most basic feelings of our drives, like I'm hungry or I'm cold, or our emotions, like I have a sense of well-being or I'm fearful, these are really ancient feelings that are probably shared through at least all the vertebrates. And then, interestingly enough, awareness itself apparently evolved three separate times, apparently. One in the vertebrates, one in the arthropods, all the other things with jointed legs like crabs and insects, and in the cephalopods, the octopuses, squids, and cuttlefish. All of these creatures are aware of the world around them and make quick decisions based on what's going on, but they have very differently organized nervous systems. They do have brains. Octopuses have several brains. It is now becoming, I would certainly say that there is a consensus that it's safe to say that any organism with a brain is aware of the world around it. And that's not to say that an octopus is worried about whether they will have a good interview for their next job or get into graduate school, but they know what's going on, and they actually recognize human faces. And they also have a tendency to like some people better than others when they are in captive settings.
Wow, this is amazing. We'll go back to consciousness. And
I'd like to interrupt you for one second before you ask that question.
Yeah.
You said twice now, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And that's what we think. We think these things are amazing. But, you know, they've always been that way. And they were here in the world before we were here. So instead of it being amazing, it should be how we understand how the world is and how all these other creatures actually are. We shouldn't be amazed. The most amazing thing is that we are such strangers in our own world, and that when we discover these little basic things about animals, we find it amazing. But really, it should be how we know and love and appreciate the world around us, which is so different than any other world we are aware of in the solar system or the universe.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, we live on a miraculous planet.
Exactly. And that's the way I experience it. Like when I say amazing, it's just like if you could get a glimpse into new universes, like as you say, in the waters, you know, when you're talking about the octopuses. And I don't know, when I was also preparing my interview for Professor Kears about the fungi networks and all of those different cosmic microcosms of universes in their own, and that they were living
right.
in the same plane without us having noticed it.
Right. And these are the things that we should be taught in school. What is the world like? Who are we here with on this planet? But instead, we go all through school, we get a diploma. People say, congratulations, now you're an educated person, you have a degree or you have a high school diploma, and you don't know where your food comes from. You don't know how your water gets to your house. You don't know where your garbage goes. You don't know where any of the things that make any of the furniture or any of the devices you're using actually came from or were made or what goes into them. You don't know anything about life around you. You don't know much about living things and biology. And you're considered an educated person. That is amazing.
Dr. Safina, talking about how sentience sense the world, and about their cognitive capacities. Distinguished research professor of English at the University of California and professor emerita of literature at Duke University, Catherine Hales, also a guest in this season, challenges traditional notions of intelligence, proposing that cognition emerges not only from human minds, but also from the complex interactions of biological, technological, and material systems. She frames intelligence in terms of how an entity processes information, adapts, and interacts with its environment, shifting the question from, is this intelligent, to what kind of intelligence is this entity showing, and under what conditions? And a model she uses when talking about how to judge whether something counts as intelligent or not is her CIRL model, which stands for sensitivity, interpretation, response, adaptation, and learning. So using this model, we just need to ask ourselves, can an orca, an elephant, a bird use its senses? Does it interpret what it senses? Does it respond to what it interprets? And does it adapt this information and learns from it? The answer, I think it's clear to me after all what we've been talking about. So in terms of your studies of animals' behavior and observations, what do you think, first of all, of this model? And before talking already about octopuses' behaviors, which do not include living in families. Could these animals fulfill these five criteria set on this model? And if yes, why?
Yeah, well, I can give you my shortest answer for this entire conversation, which is yes to all of those things. I think that that is very obvious now, and hundreds of studies confirm it. My idea of intelligence is the ability to find a new solution to a new problem. So that has to do with creativity. You know, you've never seen this problem before, but you can think of something to do to solve the problem. And there are some things that probably are maybe not intelligent at all. If we're talking about animals, you know, I said that includes corals and sponges. I'm not sure corals or sponges learn much, if anything, or maybe worms don't. Well, actually, there are experiments showing that worms can learn and worms can be conditioned. So learning is a very, very, very basic thing. Whether an animal can figure out a way of solving a new situation or confronting a new problem, and how good they are at that and how many things they can solve, I think that that shows a range of intelligence.
Well, the next excerpt couldn't come in a better moment. We will hear about evolution and intelligence based on cosmologist and physicist Judy Curryband's book, The Breath of Gaia, and where she references an incredible experiment with a slime mold.
For this experiment, researchers specifically used a plasmodial slime mold called Cephalid polycephalic polycephalum, which is a huge single cell with many different nuclei within it. Biologists put the slime mold in the middle of a plate and placed oat flakes around it. The oat flakes were not placed randomly, but rather each of them represented subway stations. The slime moves very intelligently. With its little tendrils, the mold brings its membrane out and absorbs the oat flakes without breaking the membrane of its single cell. After just a couple of hours, these single-celled beings were able to show the most effective routes between all the stations, which, by the way, were Tokyo's subway stations. When they overlaid this process of the molds, they realized it was not just the most effective way of connecting the stations, but it actually replicated the work that Japanese engineers did over a long period of time with the help of supercomputers, the exact same patterns, except, of course, being inexpensive and faster.
How do we differentiate between instinct and intelligence?
Oh, well, I think instinct is if you do something and you didn't have to learn it and you're not going to change it. I think that's instinct. But I think that in almost all animals, almost all learning is a combination of instinct learning. You know, there used to be a debate, is it nature or nurture? It's never just one or the other. It's really essentially always both things. I am familiar with the slime mold experiment and other experiments with slime molds. They are very mind-blowing because it is a single cell. They're pretty big. They're maybe up to the size of about your hand. One cell with hundreds of nuclei. Whoever heard of that? And yeah, they figure stuff out and they can remember it. So that challenges almost everything that we think about as far as, you know, we usually think that you can't be intelligent without a nervous system. Well, they only have one cell and it's not a neuron. But there are things going on in that cell that are very like what happens with a nervous system. But how is it happening? There's a lot of mysteries with slime molds, and I think they give us a lot of humility when we think we understand something about brains or minds, and then we're confronted with a single cell that can solve a problem like that in the most efficient way possible. That's really amazing. To get back to
Absolutely.
That word, amazing.
Yeah, I was just waiting for it. Talking about intelligence, emotions, and information processing, the following is a question left by a fellow guest of This Is In Mind, Professor Toby Kears, evolutionary biologist recognized for her groundbreaking research on the hidden economics of fungal plants symbiosis. She is University Research Chair in Mutualistic Interactions at Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam and co-founder of SPUN, Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, to map, protect, and advocate for the vital fungal ecosystems that sustain life on Earth.
Really? Wow. I think she just got a MacArthur Prize, didn't she?
Yeah, exactly. And she was interested in your work, and she left this question for you.
My name is Dr. Toby Kears. Dr. Safina, your work focuses on non-human animals, but my question is about emotional states. Are they exclusive to animals? Are organisms like fungi, which we know are capable of processing information, also capable of experiencing emotions?
That is the question. I would love to know the answer. I don't know the answer to that question. I think that is a very fundamental question. I'm actually writing a book right now that tries to answer a couple of questions. And one of them is, what is the most ancient and simplest form of life that actually feels things? The short answer is no one knows, and there's no consensus about it. Some people insist that every cell can feel, and some people insist that nothing without a brain can feel. Do fungi feel? That's her question. I don't know is my answer, but I will say this. These questions are not simple yes or no questions about one thing called feeling. That I think that to try to get at this, you have to chop the stages into little bits. And one stage is processing information, which I think is a phrase she used. So, first of all, every cell is incredibly complex. It's not just a little bag of fluid with a nucleus in it and some DNA. It's an incredibly complex place with thousands and thousands of chemical reactions going on all the time. The membrane of every cell has numerous sensing ports that react to chemicals around it. And in that way, it senses the environment. I'm not saying it feels the environment, but it senses. If you think of like a motion sensor or a thermostat, they sense and respond. Basic cognition, which is unconscious cognition, think of that as a category of cognition. Unconscious cognition senses, evaluates, and responds. All of this might be chemical reactions with no feeling, but every cell is capable of sensing, evaluating, and responding, every cell, because that's how they can maintain themselves as alive without just falling apart in the world of entropy and randomness. So the question is, at what stage do they feel that? We feel our cognitive aspects, some of them. Some of them we don't feel. We have nothing to do with what's going on in our kidneys. Our digestion happens by itself, although we're aware of a little bit of it. Our heart rate changes on its own. But there are other things that we are very consciously cognitive of, and we make decisions, and sometimes we override what our body might want to do. Like if we're diving underwater and our body wants to breathe, we detect that, we're conscious of that cognition, and we say, no, don't breathe yet. We have to wait till we're at the surface before breathing. But that doesn't answer the question about fungus. Fungus are very, very complicated, and they clearly communicate. But a lot of things that are not conscious communicate. Our computers communicate. Our cell phones communicate. They're sending signals. Communication is when you send a signal, it's received appropriately by some receiver that understands the same communication techniques. But that doesn't mean it's conscious. So I think it's clear that fungi are extremely complex. It's clear that they communicate a lot. I don't know if they're conscious. I would love to know what she thinks about that question.
So, Professor Toby Kears, what do you say?
Wow. It's quite hard. I mean, using the word consciousness is difficult, I think. And that's why I always try to take it back to what we can see and what we can measure, because the jury's out and I'm open to finding new things. I think that's really important in science, is that it's not, doesn't become dogmatic. We have nothing to prove in terms of understanding if fungi are conscious or not. We just want to explore their inner lives. But really probing an inner life is a different kind of scientific method that we're all just starting to explore. What I can say is that when people come into the lab and they interact with the fungi, which they can do in real time, I think that surprises people. I mean, we can actually go to the lab, we can tag the carbon with this fluorescent, beautiful label, we can take off the petri plate and we can just blow on the fungi, we can talk to the fungi, and our breath changes the direction of the flows inside it. We can interact with the fungi on our time scale and sort of probe it in ways that we can see in real time. And when people do that, that changes the way that they see fungi, I think. And, you know, the fact that they're much closely related to animals than they are to plants is quite interesting. There's just a lot right on the edges of discovery. I think the next kind of 10 to 20 years, we're going to really use science and use different methods of questioning the world to figure out a lot more about fungi and maybe about even our own consciousness.
All of this made me think about Professor Hale's work, because she does make exactly the same distinctions that you make in her integral cognitive framework about unconscious consciousness. So everything you say makes a lot of sense with what other fellow guests in this season say about the mind and consciousness. Now, Dean Radin, who is chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Science, IONS, and associate distinguished professor of integral and transpersonal psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Well, I want us to hear him on his answer to historian Dr. Elsa Richardson, who specialized in the history of medicine, when asked on whether he thinks that the microbiome might be conscious.
I think the answer requires a philosophical basis. Like in the neurosciences today, probably most neuroscientists believe that consciousness is somehow generated by the brain, that the brain activity creates awareness. And one of the ways of showing that is that if you give somebody an anesthetic, then their awareness goes away. And we know that that affects brain function. So there's some reasons to think that, yeah, there's some degree of awareness is probably related to brain function. But the neurons that are active in the brain are also active in the gut. In fact, the gut is sometimes called the second brain, the belly brain. It has its own form of intelligence where it can digest without the need for the brain to be active. This is why if somebody is brain dead, you can keep them alive because you put food down into the stomach and it knows what to do. There's a certain intelligence there. The question, though, is whether it is aware. Is it self-aware that it is doing it? Well, up until maybe 20 years ago, the answer probably would be no. It's not complex enough to be able to be self-aware. But in the last 20 years, a really radical change has happened in the neurosciences and in biology, where now a growing number of people who deal with plants and who deal with animals and insects are beginning to say that plants have a certain degree of consciousness, as do all animals, as do even insects are aware. They have awareness. They don't have human-type awareness, But do they have some form of awareness of the environment and of themselves, whatever that might mean to a plant? The answer appears to be yes. So the microbiome in particular is a whole bunch of bacteria that is in your body. Well, maybe the individual bacteria are aware. Is the collective aware? We don't know. I mean, we have trillions of individual cells and bacteria in our body. We experience ourselves as one awareness, but maybe that's simply a limitation of the way that we look at it.
So we don't know. What would be your definition of consciousness from an animal kingdom perspective? You already mentioned something about this when you were speaking about the scientific consensus.
Well, yeah, my definition of consciousness is awareness. It's the same thing. If you are aware and if you feel something, you are conscious. Then that could be a very, very, very basic form of consciousness or a very complex form of consciousness. But there's a big difference between something that does not feel anything, and let's make it easy and not talk about single cells. Let's talk about rocks. Rocks don't feel anything. I'm almost 100% sure of that. But a dog does. And I'm 100% sure of that. It appears that living things are the only things with any consciousness. It appears certain that any living thing with a brain at all, it appears certain that anything with a brain is conscious, it feels, it is aware. And the question then becomes, if you have no nervous system, are you able to feel anything? That remains the question. No one has a good or clear answer to that, and there's no consensus. There are some people who say, yes, every bacterial cell does feel. I've read a lot of their arguments. I don't find them convincing, but it still remains a possibility. There are people who say, even Darwin said that the roots of plants act a lot like brains act in terms of sensing and sending information to the rest of the organism. Do plants feel anything? Some people, and I'm talking about science people, insist yes, and most science people insist no when it comes to plants, which means it's not clear. And no one can say really for sure. They may feel sure, but no one really knows enough yet to say definitively whether they do or not. The same answer for fungi and the same answer for all living things. Clearly, animals with brains, yes. And not clearly, living things with no nervous systems. That remains to be seen. And the thing with the slime molds raises such a fascinating possibility and question.
Absolutely. And you're mentioning Darwin and this thing about the roots in the work of Professor Toby Kears. You know that she compares economic theories in how the fungi exchange information and nutrients and sugars and so on. Well, the hubs where everything happens are the roots that act like little brains. Let's listen.
So trade in these networks between plants and mycorrhizal fungi happen at very specialized structures called arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. Arbuscules are beautiful structures that are formed and found inside plant roots. So you can imagine a mycorrhizal network is actually penetrating into a root cell, and then it forms this very intricate and delicate structure called an arbuscule that looks like a mini tree, actually, inside the network. And that's where the trade takes place. That's where the carbon is loaded into the fungal network, and that's where the phosphorus is exchanged from the fungal side. Now, there's a lot of work going on trying to understand the dynamics of these arbuscules because they're such powerhouses of where the interaction takes place. and still so much to learn. But one interesting thing that scientists have discovered in recent years is just how ephemeral they are. They can form and then they can collapse, typically within about 7 days. And one of the experiments that we're doing right now is to really understand all of the different mechanisms by which these fungi may be processing information. And one of those is to look at the actual electrical activity in these networks. This is a whole new field that we're getting into right now that allows us to actually introduce a stimuli to a network and then see how that information may be moving across the network by measuring voltage changes. One of the big questions we have right now is whether decisions in fungal networks are dominated by what we call local rules or global rules. So is there just something happening very locally that allows, you know, tens of thousands of tips to coordinate together to make a decision? Or are there really global rules where it really is a coordination of billions of fungal tips and that the fungus is acting like a calculator in many ways? So there's lots of competing hypotheses about how this can work. But it's really, I think, going to challenge our understanding of cognition and challenge our understanding of information processing in organisms that don't have a central nervous system.
And talking about big families and matrices and the way these families communicate, the story of vocalization of whales is amazing. Again, the word amazing. And I learned that even when whales share the same waters, they might belong to different clans, and that each clan has its own distinct way of communicating, as different from one another as, say, Chinese or French. And within those clans, there are even smaller groups or pods that have their own dialects and accents. How fascinating are their communication skills? How close are we to unravel whales' languages or dialects?
I don't know how close we are. The thing you're talking about is with sperm whales particularly, not with all kinds of whales, because they're all a bit different. And sperm whales are really quite different from most other whales. Of all of the big whales, sperm whales are the only ones who have teeth. They're not closely related to the other big whales like humpback whales or blue whales. We don't know how close we are because we're not there yet. There's a new project called SETI, C-E-T-I. I can't remember what that acronym stands for in English. I can't remember. Something about searching for intelligent life on Earth. And they're using machine learning and AI stuff that I don't really know about to look for patterns and untangle what the whales might be saying to each other. One thing we certainly know for sure, as you were saying, is the amazing fact that they have very well-defined social structures where among a huge population, there are different clans, and within clans, there are different pods, and within pods, there are individuals, and they can communicate and announce all of that stuff at different levels with different patterns of vocalization. So with sperm whales, the only vocalizations they make are clicking noises. So they click kind of like Morse code. It's very different than humpback whales and their singing and all of the sounds that they make, or orcas that sound like flocks of birds that have all these different vocalizations. But the sperm whales only have these patterns of clicks. And we do know that they can say who they are, where they are, who they belong to. It may be that that's all they need to be saying, and it may be that they're saying a lot more than that that we don't know yet. I think that with the orcas, the patterns of vocalizations are astonishingly intricate and hugely rich in sounds and kinds of sounds and sound patterns. And there's circumstantial evidence, or maybe you'd say anecdotal evidence, that orca whales and some dolphins are actually able to communicate some pretty detailed information to one another. But we might be a few years away from understanding that much better. We might be decades away. I don't really know.
Well, thank you for making those clarifications that helps us educate a little bit better myself, of course. And could you give us an example of how language enables these groups to transfer knowledge from generation to generation?
Well, I think that one of the main ways that they transfer knowledge generationally is for the social groups to be stable and for the young ones to simply see how we live here. That's really what culture does. We think of culture as fashion and sports and religion and music. That is not culture. Those are the products of culture. What culture is the way that we understand how do we in our group live here in our place. That's what culture is. And humans have by far the most complex cultures because we have so many cultures within our own culture at different levels. But there are some other animals that have cultures. They do think that the species does things differently in different places. And how they learn how to do things differently in different places is young ones watch adults and learn what to do. They learn where to go. They learn what is food here, what is not food here, where the water is, what is dangerous, where we go in the wintertime when it gets too cold, those kinds of things.
In terms of human culture, what would you say are the most distinguishable groups of animals exhibiting culture? And could you give us a couple of examples? Well, you were already mentioning some of them.
We mentioned the sperm whales. So the most cultural non-human probably is chimpanzees. They're all built the same. They all could physically do the same things. But in some areas, the chimpanzees use no wooden tools. In other areas, they use several wooden tools to accomplish the same task, like breaking into a beehive to get honey, for instance. In another area, they use stones and wooden tools. They use stones to crack nuts. But in other areas, they don't use stones. And so, you know, if a young chimpanzee grew up in a different area, they would learn to do that. Just like if a human was born in the Amazon rainforest, they would learn how to live in the Amazon rainforest. But if you brought them to the Arctic, they would die. If you took a baby and they grew up in the Arctic, they would learn how to live in the Arctic. And if you brought them to the Amazon rainforest, they would die. That's what culture does. It shows us how do we live here. Wolves are another one. They live in stable social groups. And some of those groups learn to kill very large animals, bison, which weigh something like 10 to 20 times as much as a wolf. A lot of groups of wolves don't know how to attack and kill bison, but some do. Some wolves know how to catch fish in streams, and many never do that. And with dolphins, also live in stable social groups. Some of them specialize in certain techniques of hunting that others never do. Some of them specialize in hunting with humans. That's happened in several places around the world where the dolphins have either learned or actually taught human fishermen who stand along the shore with nets that they throw. The dolphins and the humans have somehow figured out and learned together that the dolphins can find fish, push them near the shore where the humans can throw the nets, but inevitably some fish only get injured in the nets and don't get caught, and the dolphins can easily catch the injured fish. In some cases, the fishermen will throw the dolphins some fish, and this is an interspecies cooperative thing, which obviously involves both of them really thinking at the exact same level about what's going on. And there are more animals than you would think who have culture and learn it in that social way from the adults and a little bit from their peers, but mostly from the adults who have learned it in their generation. By far, not all animals have culture, but a lot more than we would have thought. And in fact, you know, around the year 2000, let's say, most people thought that only humans had any culture at all. And in the last 20 or 25 years, we've learned a lot differently from that. Even some fish have culture, for instance.
Yeah, and you know, now that you're touching on that, in one of these documentaries I was mentioning at the beginning, actually it's a film that is called Generations of Sounds. And this film, Paul Sponge, that it's the founder of Orca's Lab, or Orca Lab, something like that, talks about how some groups of orcas display a kind of recreational behavior of play, which is actually one of the highest standards, I think, for a mind to show consciousness and awareness and to be part of a culture, like a sort of tradition. And how it involved this group of orcas to play around their bodies against smooth gravel and pebbles in shallow waters. And what was really astonishing was that this tradition, as you're mentioning, is not practiced by all whales or orcas living in the same area, which was British Columbia. It's as if each group of would have its, not only its language or dialect, but its own social world, right?
Right. Yes, yes, and that's a very good example. You've done a lot of really good preparation for this conversation. I really appreciate how well you have prepared for this.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Safina. That's the least I can do after reading your books that are so fascinating. In these interactions, when you're thinking about culture, and in reading also your book Becoming Wild, which I highly, highly recommend, it's an extraordinary book, I thought about how disputes both inside and outside a human family can be moderated by cultural values, and that perhaps also animals have their own values in their own families. Could you give us perhaps, if there are, one or two examples of how culture in animals can help ease conflict within a family or in a community?
Well, in chimpanzees, which is maybe the best example of this, you know, they live in stable groups as well, where the males never leave the group they were born into. Females do leave the group they were born into, and they have to find another group that will accept them. So that's the basis of chimpanzee social structure. But there's also these highest ranking males or alpha males. I really don't like that term, alpha males, but there are the most dominant males. And they achieve their dominance violently. They fight for it. Usually they become contenders when they get to be about 30 years old. Not all of the males that get that old have that ambition. A lot of them do. They form coalitions, sometimes to topple the one who is the most dominant already. Why is dominance an advantage? Because the dominant ones get the best access to food and to potential mates. So that's very, very basic stuff. There's a lot of fighting and scrapping and scrambling around in chimpanzee societies. And because of that, and because they do need to get along, because the societies are also stable, they have skills that they use and that they learn from their parents about how to appease a dominant individual, or how to make up with somebody you've had a fight with. Or sometimes two that have had a bad fight will get kind of near each other. They still are very uncomfortable with each other. And one who is on good terms with both of them will get in the middle and will act as a mediator to get them to sort of slowly come together and make up and get over what the problem was. I think also very interestingly, in many of our own homes, we have dogs. Many people have pet dogs.
Sure.
Dogs always want to make up and get past whatever the problem was. They never want to stay mad. They always want to get past it. And I think that all of these things are interesting and instructive for humans, because we, like chimpanzees, we live in social groups where people struggle for dominance. There's a lot of disagreement and discord and sometimes fighting, sometimes war. And we need ways to get over it. And these things are not just things that people invented. You know, they come from our deep animal roots, as we see with, for instance, chimpanzees.
Exactly. And you're so right. And talking about dogs being like loving equalizers of families. We were watching this documentary of orcas. You know, it was so interesting to see how much the personality of the matriarch influences the whole family. And we were watching this. I have to share this with you. I have two sons and my husband. So I'm in among men. And my seven-year-old, he said, you know, the documentary came and said, when the matriarch is nervous, indecisive, calm or bold, it sets the tone for the whole family. And he just turned at me and said, exactly like here, Mom.
That's great.
Following, we will hear an excerpt about a fellow guest in this season, internationally acclaimed photographer Domingo Milella, born in Puglia, Italy, and for whom the sea is an essential part of his identity's landscape. Let's hear what he has to say about whales and our limited human-centered view of art as an expression of culture.
My relationship with whales, it's very strong and it's very instinctual. I can't explain it, but I feel related to these underwater creatures. These mammals have something that makes me feel brotherhood or sisterhood. And this similarity, whenever I've encountered them at sea, is a very special emotion, because it's understanding that you are not alone. Beside all the human creations and the artificiality of society and of culture, there is something about understanding the relationship of species and the connection with the larger ecosystem that is extremely important. And the song, it's the demonstration that we give art as one of the primordial representation of the human species as we wanted to see, as we want to see ourselves. But the fact that some species of whale can communicate each other in undecipherable codes across hundreds of miles of bodies of waters, it's a demonstration of our size, and also the size of our art and of our ambition.
And thinking about art, beauty plays, of course, a major role. And in your book, again, Becoming Wild, you talk about culture, how it is conceptualized. And also, you make a brilliant observation. You tap upon the concept of beauty as an evolutionary and rewarding force and the role played by perception. I thought this was fascinating. Could you elaborate a bit more on this refined idea on how you see beauty shaping behavior and evolution?
Yeah, well, we equate evolution with a lot of what Darwin first wrote about it, that certain animals are better able to survive, and so they survive, and they have more offspring who survive, and others don't. Or don't do as well, and that results over time in all the shapes and diversification that we see. But Darwin realized that that did not answer a lot of what he saw around him, which is all of these extravagant things, all of this beauty in the living world, these strange plumes that looked like they had nothing to do with just surviving or finding food. And he realized that his initial theory of natural selection did not account for that. So he thought there must be something else also going on. And he wrote another book that is about sexual selection. And what this is about is that for some animals, the way that a potential mate looks is an indication of how healthy they are, right? So birds are a really good example for all of this stuff. And they're the most familiar wild animals for most of us. And we know that many birds have beautiful plumage. So why do they have beautiful plumage? Why aren't they all camouflaged? And Darwin said, well, because when they're selecting mates, and usually it's females usually choose males, not the other way around in most other animals. Humans are different because in humans, males and females both choose each other. But in many other animals, it's females have the luxury of choosing males. So they see a male who is healthier and maybe their feathers are brighter because they're healthier. So they choose that one, because if you choose that one, you will be more successful at reproducing. So that tendency to choose becomes fixed in the population. But then it's, well, am I going to choose the one that's bright? Because now they're all bright. Maybe it's a million years later. Now they're all bright, but a couple of them are really, really bright. And a couple of them have feathers that are particularly noticeable. And over all of this time, these extravagant feathers, like a peacock, are pushed to these extremes by the choices of females over millions of years. And in natural selection, it's the conditions of the world decide whether you're going to live or die out there. But in sexual selection, it's life choosing, actively choosing what life will look like. And so beauty plays a big role in how many things around us in the animal world actually look, because many animals, like this tiger behind me, has all these markings for camouflage. It's not just for beauty. It's a very practical thing. But a peacock has that tail, a male peacock has that tail only because that's what females want. Flowers look and smell the way they do because they need to attract insects, but insects find it attractive. And that pushes flowers to look and smell the way that they do over huge stretches of time that these things have evolved to become the way they are right now. So in the world around us, a lot of what we see is beautiful because attraction has been a major force in evolution. And what I find really fascinating is that since I am not a bee, but I find flowers beautiful and the scent of flowers beautiful, I am not a female peacock, but I find the male peacock beautiful. I'm not about to fly to the sun, but I find a sunset beautiful. Why is it that we have this feeling of beauty in the world around us where attraction to beauty has actually been such a strong force? And I think that we have evolved to feel at home in the world and to see the world as beautiful. Most people, if you ask them, what is your favorite color? Most people, it's either blue or green. And those are the dominant colors of the world itself. And I think that this sense of beauty, we see things around us all the time, say, oh, that's beautiful. Oh, that's really lovely. Oh, that's great. I like the way that looks. And beauty is a major driver in our lives. And I think that the reason we have a capacity to even have a sense of the beautiful is that it has been such a major part in the evolution of life on Earth. But it is a very, very underappreciated part of evolution. Most people focus on Darwin's idea about the struggle for life and have kind of forgotten everything he said about, well, the struggle for life doesn't account for a lot of what we see. It's this sense of beauty that accounts for a lot of the other part that we see also.
Dr. Safina, now that you are saying that and talking about that so clearly, you made me think about the concept of beauty in relationship, as you were saying, to a driving force, seeing something that is healthy, that is in equilibrium. And that takes me directly to Richard Mulica's work. Professor Richard Mulica is an expert in trauma, and he has a system to heal through beauty. He thinks beauty brings healing. And he not only thinks that, he has achieved that with many people suffering in wars and overcoming tremendous trauma. He has seen how a small space turned into a house, even, let's say, a bamboo house in Cambodia, for example, that is clean, that it looks inviting. How the sense of returning to dignity and beauty has an effect in the healing process. So what you're saying about this force, it's really on the core of our existence, I think.
Yes, well, let me try to say a couple of things about that. If we could possibly imagine a life where we have shelter from the elements and food, I'm thinking of kind of like living in a concrete shelter, and somehow there's enough food and we're alive, right? That would be a terrible existence. What makes life worth living and all of the effort it takes to stay alive is actually the beauty in our lives. Beauty is what makes life worth living. And there are many forms of beauty. There's physical beauty of just what we might see around us, trees and flowers and things like that. There's the beauty of food. We don't just get served, you know, the same basic food every day. We like to try new things. We like to make the food look nice when we present it. That is an aesthetic thing. And when food is delicious, it's also beautiful. Our families, when we have good relationships in our families, which doesn't happen all the time, but many of us do most of the time, it's beautiful. Beauty is what makes life worth all of the effort it takes to be alive. So we tend to think that it's the last thing that you add on after all the basics are in place. But without it, the basics aren't even worth it. So it's an enormously basic thing. In fact, I think it's so basic that if you could imagine the first kind of creature that might have felt anything at all. So try to imagine something like a worm on the seabed in some ancient sea a billion years ago, and it might be the first thing that can feel anything at all. What does it need to feel? It probably needs to feel if it has just bumped into some food, and the rest of the time it's bumping into mud or stones or something like that. So if it bumps into mud or stones, the most basic feeling would be no. And if it bumps into food, the most basic feeling would be yeah. That is an aesthetic judgment. It's positive versus negative. It's good versus bad. It would prefer what seems good and feels good, right? So I actually think that detecting something and perceiving it as good, which is very much adjacent to beautiful and makes you want to be near it in the same kind of way, I think that is the most basic feeling in living things.
I think so too. And you know, the way these animals are physically built in relation to their senses, humans too, ourselves, and how we perceive or they perceive the world, as well as the time they invest in their relationships and the different phases they go through together, from being inexperienced and young to becoming leaders of their herd or pack, For females experiencing menopause, in some cases, as in whales, and being able to transmit knowledge and teach, and also be able to mourn, and the way they react to loss. It is so wondrous, and it's also adjacent to this beauty we're talking about. And I mean, animals don't just suffer in body, they can suffer in mind, in memory, in loss, in longing. When you think about their pain, how it matches or it's parallel to, how is it similar to ours, and the depth that goes beyond the physical. I mean, and think of these, I prepare an excerpt. I didn't thought about making these parallels with beauty, but it does has beauty in it because it will take us to empathy. And so we will hear about a terrible accident in which a horse, Fregonero, stumbled and fell on top of his beloved young rider, taking his life at age 13. After this accident, the journalist Pedro Diaz published an article citing Piero's mother, Ana Rita, talking about her mourning and how Fregonero, the horse, was just as she, in tremendous pain.
I rode Fregonero. After the accident, he went without food for almost a week. When I talk about this, people think we're telling a story, but it's true. The horse is sadder than me, his mother. Believe me, he stayed in his stall, never turned around, just stared at the wall all the time. The first day I took him out, it was like he was hurt. He didn't even want to walk. He was in pain inside. He accompanied me on this journey. Literally, he accompanied me. My goal every day was to get up and go to see him, to cry together a little, and to make him understand, him too, that life has to go on.
To me, this can only be understood in terms of empathy and compassion. But am I being too romantic, or are they indeed capable of empathy and compassion? Do you see the way they mourn and express deep pain as proof of these?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, horses evolved to live in social groups, so they have a capacity to have feelings for their social companions. And I think that that probably has to be the case for any animals that live in stable social groups, that they have a capacity for knowing who they are with, that that helps them create their own identity. How do we know who we are? We know who we are by knowing who we are with and where we are. And they have exactly the same experience of life. And that gives them their identity. The dogs that we have as pets, they know who they are by who they're with and where they are. And they, if humans look like they're in any kind of distress at all, the dogs are very upset. They'll come right over and doing what they might be doing to try to help you or check you out or make sure you might be okay. We see that kind of a lot. We had three dogs this past spring, and one of them died of old age in May. And the one that was raised with him looked like she was very, very sick around the same time. And for about 2 months after that, I thought she was probably going to die also by the end of the summer. But by the end of the summer, she just got a lot better. Nothing changed. And I think that she was just missing her companion. And I think she was distressed over his distress as he was dying because nothing else changed. That's my best guess about what was going on with her. So, yeah, I think there's a writer named Barbara King. Barbara J. King. She wrote a book about empathy in other animals, and she said that you can see grief in a change in behavior. So if an animal dies, the one who was closest to it or maybe the mate will change their behavior, like they won't eat, like the clip that you just played. The horse did not eat for a week, or they wander around and go to places that they never went before. A story that was told to me about a wolf whose mate was killed. She went out on a snowy plateau for a week where there was nothing to eat. She just wandered around and then came back. we here in my backyard, we had an experience. We had some chickens and one pair of ducks. And the male duck got sick and died. And the female, just for like 2 weeks, she just went around and around the yard calling and calling and calling and calling. Obviously, he was on her mind and she missed him. She was looking for him. So, yeah, absolutely.
You were mentioning dogs. And, you know, I had a dog whom I loved so much. And her name was Sarah. When I felt pregnant, she knew. When I was ill, she knew. She always knew, and I remember her as a puppy seeing snow for the very first time, how she stopped, lifted her little face to the sky, and watched the flakes around her with such a quiet wonder. And on the day we had to put her to sleep, I held her close to me. You know, there was a moment of big, big connection that I can hardly put into words, where she made a very, very deep breath that reminded me how she used to come after our walks and sought refuge between my legs and breathed so deeply as to say, I'm home. And, well, in that moment, her head was resting on one side and she looked at me and then took one last breath and finally let go. And that memory is so powerful. It still brings tears to my eyes. It makes me wonder whether animals have souls, or at least a kind of consciousness we don't yet understand. And I can help but link those small moments of awareness, including that big final moment, to the greater mystery of life and death. And when it comes to dogs and the strong bonds they form within a family, one animal that really stands out for its strong family bonds and pack dynamics is the wolf, the closest ancestor of the dog. And a few years ago, George Church and his team made a bold attempt to bring back the Pleistocene wolves of the Ice Age, basically trying to resurrect ancient wolves from the past using DNA extracted from specimens trapped in permafrost. Well, critics questioned whether it was ethical to create animals just for experimentation and so on. And there was a big, big debate about these ecological risks. And fast forward to the early 2025, scientists at Colossal Biosciences have now used gene editing technology to create genetically modified gray wolves with traits of the extinct direwolf. And, you know, using CRISPR, they alter the wolf's genes, and after some cloning, I think three pups were born, Romulus, Remus, and Khaleesi. And while these pups aren't perfect replica of the extinct dire wolves, they are stepped closer to what many are calling de-extinction. Dr. Safina, what are your thoughts in these kinds of experiments? Are the arguments of de-extinction somehow cynic? Do they carry some truth? Are we even talking about wolves the way we know them today?
Okay, well, we're talking about, with the de-extinction question, we're talking about animals being born. But let's get to the de-extinction thing. There are animals who have gone extinct who could live now. Carolina parakeet went extinct in the 1800s only because people shot them all, basically. They could live now. Passenger pigeon probably could live now at much lower abundances than it used to live when the continent of North America was almost completely unsettled by humans, or at least there were vast, vast forests. There were a lot of humans, but nothing like the transformation that has gone on in the last few centuries. But there's no passenger pigeons because people shot them all. They could live now. And that DNA is easily available in specimens in museums that are only 100 years old or 200 years old, 150 years old, that would be worth trying if you really want to de-extinct something. A big danger in this whole conversation is I've spoken to people who say, well, we don't have to worry about anything going extinct because we can bring them back anytime we want. Now, that's a terrible thought. It's not even true. It's never been done. And the idea that we don't have to worry about anything going extinct and we can just let things go extinct left and right because someday we might decide to bring something back, maybe, is a real danger of this whole conversation. But if you want to talk about bringing things back that could live now that should never have gone extinct, well, there are a bunch of examples. If you're talking about mammoths and dire wolves, they went extinct on their own because the world couldn't support them anymore. A warming world will never support a mammoth, and elephants have to grow up in families. Even if a mammoth fell out of an elephant in a zoo someplace because somebody somehow actually cloned one, it would be a lost animal. There's no place in the world for that. The dire wolf thing was just a stunt. There are some wolves now who are doomed to captivity for their entire lives because they have a few dire wolf genes in them, so that this company can have a gigantic press hit and get lots of publicity. So when the idea of de-extinction first arose, like from Jurassic Park, could you take DNA and bring back something that should never have been driven extinct and could live in the world today? I thought, wow, that's a really great idea. But the way it's being thought of and the way it's being done is absurd and very irresponsible.
Just hubris. How can we create laws that genuinely protect ecosystems and endangered species while avoiding loopholes and the dangers of political and techno-capitalistic demagoguery?
Oh, I wish I knew. You know, the United States had the environmental movement in the 1970s and all these really fantastic federal laws, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, a number of others, and they have made a big difference. But there are constantly people trying to unravel, undo, get around them, completely repeal them. So I don't know how you get everyone to really want to just love the world and aid human dignity. That seems like a really simple agenda to me, but it is not widely shared. And in the United States, it's going backwards right now. I wish I had a better answer for you.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with Cece.
We started our conversation talking about how we can better observe animals. But next, we will listen to Professor Hales talk about dogs and their capacity to understand and observe us humans.
Oh, well, the reason that dogs and humans have been companions for thousands of years is because our dogs know exactly what we're thinking. They're really expert at interpreting body language, finest nuances of tones. They will sense when we are anxious even before we're consciously aware of being anxious. And there are many stories about dogs being able to sense when a seizure, epileptic seizure, is coming on, for example, or even being able to sense when their owner has an undiagnosed cancer. So with that superb sense of smell that they have and their sensitivity to human language and body gestures, I think there's a lot of intra-communication going on there.
In your amazing book, Alfie and Me, which I'm reading with my son, you share a deeply moving story of rescuing and caring for an orphaned screech owl, reflecting on trust and the sense of connection. In a time overwhelmed by technology, loneliness, and disconnection, what do you think animals like Alfie can teach us about empathy and belonging?
Well, what that little owl has taught me, and by the way, that book is about the first year that she was free and her first brood of young ones that she raised. She is 7 years old now. She has raised 21 young ones with two different mates because her first mate died, and she got a new mate 2 years later. The last time I saw her was just 3 hours ago, just this morning. And what has she taught me? Well, the reason I saw her this morning, while it was still dark, just getting light, is that she came to a tree right above my head and started calling to me. She knows who I am. I'm obviously one of the big individuals in her life. Her ability to relate and to know individuals was very surprising to me, and it should not have been surprising because it's the way they are. But when do we ever get to see that in wild birds? We never get to know a wild bird as an individual unless something extraordinary happens, like this dying baby owl was found. And when we succeeded in raising her and releasing her and she stuck around, we became friends. When do you ever become friends with a wild animal? You almost never get to see that kind of insight into how they really are. And how these owls really are is that they know who they're with and they know where they are and they relate to one another. They come looking for each other, like she comes looking for me. You know, she likes to be near us sometimes. She is completely confident with us if we go into her nest or even are right around her babies. No problem. She's not at all nervous because she trusts us so much. She knows our dogs, who she grew up with, but she's afraid of strange dogs because dogs can be dangerous. So what she really was like a portal to this whole wild world around me and to how much the inhabitants of that world really know what's going on. You know, that clip that you just played about the sensitivity of dogs, you know, often knowing what's going on with owners before the owners even know what's going on with themselves, or knowing that a seizure is about to happen. I mean, imagine if the dogs could simply talk to us. They'd probably ask us, why are you all so dumb? Why are you in charge when we're so much smarter than you? And the world to us is so much more vivid, and we detect so many more things that you are completely oblivious to.
Yeah, so, or why are you so angry? Why are you so focused on that little thing?
Yes, exactly. Why does everything upset you?
And, you know, you're talking about trust and connection and how those things were brought to you by this bird, by Alfie. And now that we think in our rapidly changing world, not only in terms of technology, but values and the pace that it's reflected not only in our mental health, which is a real thing, a real crisis going on, in our planet, from deforestation and plastic pollution to mass species extinction, and the fact that we are in front of an environmental damage, but also a moral and spiritual disconnection from this living world. How is it that these little creatures can help us understand that by rescuing the planet and by rescuing these connections with the animals, with the plants, with our living systems, we can rescue ourselves?
The question is, how is it? Is that the question?
Yeah. How does this click happen?
Let me just say, it works for me. If I was only reading the news, if I was only going to work in a building, I would be a pretty unhappy person. But I do think that my life is balanced in a really beautiful way. We talked about beauty. Just because we live in a kind of a nice place, kind of nice meaning that there are trees around us, there are birds in the backyard, we have our dogs. We live near the shore. I often bring the dogs to walk at the beach. And when I go to the beach with the dogs, I bring my binoculars. I check out what seabirds are around. It's getting to be now well into the autumn. And in this time of the year, some animals come down from the north. We have seals that are coming. We have some of the winter ducks that breed in the Arctic. And this is part of the wild and original world. These animals are there in the world like they've always been in the world. And just to go for a walk on the beach with the dogs and see these animals really makes me feel really connected to the rest of the world and also to the history of life on Earth. Just thinking, these animals have been here for many thousands of years. The island that I live on, Long Island, outside of New York, has been here for about 20,000 years. It's not very long in the history of life on Earth. It's part of the glacial history of North America from the last ice ages, because the island was pushed by the ice sheets. It's just a bunch of sand and gravel that makes this island, which is 120 miles long. I don't know what that is, 200 kilometers or something like that. And all of this connects me, you know, before I read any bad news or before I have to work on something that is distressing, I have a little bit of beauty in the day. And that is a necessary balance to keep me sane. Sometimes I say, try to stay reasonably well and unreasonably sane in these times and what's going on right now in this very distressing world that we're in.
Well, Dr. Safina, I want to say thank you for an incredible interview and for all the mindfulness work you've done, showing the world that intelligence, empathy, grief, and joy are not solely human traits, but rather shared threads woven through the living fabric of this planet.
Well, I think that you have helped show that intelligence, dignity, grief, and joy are part of the human capacity, because you're an exceptionally good interviewer. This was an exceptionally enjoyable conversation. I really appreciated everything that you had to say and everything that you wanted us to talk about. The clips that you included were just exactly appropriate. I've really, really enjoyed this time with you. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you very much. You're too generous, sir. And thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. Shall you wish to follow Dr. Safina's steps, including his book and work, or support any of the Safina Center projects, visit their website at www.carlsafina.org or follow him on social media. For more information, do not forget to check this episode's description. See you next time. Bye-bye. I keep sticking to